Recording has started. You may now proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the fourth GNSOE PDP team meeting on Tuesday, the 14th of August, 2018 at 1300 UTC for 2 hours. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you were only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no one, we have listed apologies from Ben Butler from ESSEC and Giorgio Silentis from GAP. They have formally assigned Rod Rasmussen and Lorene Kalin as their alternates for this call and for the remaining days of their absence. During the period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to the conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the member return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment must be formalized by the way of the Google assignment form. Link is available in the agenda pod. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you do need assistance updating your statement of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the ePDP Wiki space. There's an audio cast for non-members to follow the call, so please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you very much, and I'll turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks very much, and hello, everybody, and thanks for being here for a timely start. I hope everybody has their dog-eared copy of the temporary specification in one hand and the spreadsheet with our comments and comment summaries and on top as well as this. So here's the agenda, and let's just touch on a couple things before we get into the substance of the meeting. So first, the face-to-face meeting is scheduled to be held in Los Angeles, California, and it will occur on Monday, September 24th through Wednesday, September 26th. We plan for a full 3 days. If we finish ahead of time, we can all go to Disneyland or something like that. So, I think by that time we'll be hitting the crux or the most critical issues. So I think Since almost all of us will be traveling, it's time to make best use of that time. And so I'm indulging in asking that everybody attend for a three-day meeting. So that's all I have about the face-to-face meeting. I know that there I hope I'm speaking clearly, Caboose. And do you have a comment about this? Go ahead, Caboose.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, all distinguished colleagues. I hesitate to comment in this very technical and professional meeting on visa entry policy of certain countries in imposing general ban on the nationals of certain specific countries, preventing them to enter in that country. My comments are addressed to ICANN, the organization, in holding a meeting of ICANN or a meeting of its constituency or a stakeholder group in such a country, which prevent attendance in face-to-face meeting being scheduled in that country. This is not the first time that such inattentive decision is made by ICANN, the organization, in organizing a meeting in a country in which such policy applies. National of those countries on which the general ban was applied could not attend ICANN 61 in Puerto Rico for the same reason, as the venue was in a country or geographic territory to which the jurisdiction of standing country applied. The purpose of this statement is twofold. On the one hand, I strongly object for the intention of ICANN to organize or plan to hold a meeting face-to-face in a country which imposed general ban on granting entry visa to the nationals of specific countries for the second time in less than 6 months. And on the other hand, to respectfully and seriously ask the ICANN, the organization, to avoid organizing any ICANN meeting or any face-to-face meeting in future in any country or geographic territory which continue to impose the above-mentioned general ban on the nationals of certain specific countries. This is not in accordance with general purpose of the ICANN, which is internationalized organizations or globalized organizations, non-discriminative, democratic, and open to everybody. By this meeting in Los Angeles, some people are prevented to attend the meeting. So ICANN should avoid that in future, and I draw the attention of the president and CEO of ICANN and any other involved person to kindly take that into account in future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Caruso. That was well put and concise. So thank you very much for taking the time to think through that and present it. ICANN on the next topic, communications plan. So one of our requirements under the charter is to communicate fully, early, and often with the GNSO Council and the community, and that'll be done through direct periodic communications, either newsletters or updates. But the ICANN staffs put together a more comprehensive plan that will allow us to provide a roadmap to allow us to communicate in a variety of ways, depending on the issue, the sense of urgency, and the audience. So, does anybody from the ICANN staff side want to take just a minute and describe where to find that and how it might be used? Marika?
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. This is Marika. So as Kurt noted, we've worked closely together with Ariel, who I think many of you know is also responsible for GNSO communication in general, in developing a proposed communications plan that outlines a number of avenues that the group can use to communicate, both milestones as well as opportunities for input. So the proposal is that following this meeting, we'll share that with the list so you all have an opportunity to review that and provide input and or further suggestions that you may have in the ways in which the group can ensure meeting the charter requirements when it comes to regular communications, both to the council as well as the broader community.
Thanks, Marika. And I think we'll be relying on you guys to make sure we fulfill the requirements in the charter, because, our my bent, and I hope our focus is like keeping our heads down and working. So thanks very much for paying attention to that. The third bullet item, we've had a request from the RISG, the Registry Stakeholder Group, and also from the GAC, and others have mentioned that those of you listening from home on the audio stream don't have full access to all the information, and trying to address that. So, Christina, if you want to amplify your request, or anyone else who's commented about that, you're welcome to. But if you want to defer, we've been talking about this for quite some time and took the comment on board very seriously. So we have a response of things we're working on. But Christina, do you want to mention something?
Hi, Christina Rosette for the transcript. No, I tried to be very succinct and to the point in my post to the list. The only thing that I would add more from a process perspective is that to the extent that there is consensus on this request, at least among the GNSO participants, I would ask, or I'd like to ask them that Rafiq take the request back to the GNSO Council. I think it really is important, particularly because alternates do on occasion, and in fact for the registry stakeholder group starting tomorrow, do need to participate on behalf of a member that they have read-only access to complete information. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Christina. Alex, I'm going to skip over you and go to Laureen because she also wrote, but not to the full group. Laureen?
Thanks so much. And actually, as of yesterday, I couldn't write to the full group because I was still in an alternate status. However, I also just wanted to add, for the same reasons that Christina has mentioned, that the lack of real-time access really hobbles our ability to confer in real time with our colleagues who are primary members. And also it's hard to follow sometimes where it isn't clear what slide we're on, and the whole thing is a little bit of a second-class experience, if I may say. That said, the other thing I wanted to add is I looked over the charter, and I did not see an explicit reference to barring alternates from real-time access to the Adobe room. Rather, there's references to bar observers, but alternates are not observers. It's a separate status. So I just wanted to add that to the extent it makes things easier in terms of resolving this issue, there does not seem to be an explicit bar in the charter for alternates to have real-time access to the Adobe room, and I assume that alternates would respect the rules of the road regarding refraining from making comments either audibly or to the full group via a chat message. And that would be distinct, I think, from one-on-one messages, which I would argue should be allowed, because often the whole purpose of allowing this is so that you can confer with your like-minded colleagues. Thanks so much for letting me speak.
Sure, Laureen. And, you know, I was sort of the mind you were on the charter, but it's in, as the U.S. Supreme Court once said, it's in the penumbras. So, Alex, Alan, Emily, and Aiden. So this is a non-substantive topic that we're pretty ready to respond to. So unless you're against the proposal, if you want to take time your hands, it'd be great. But I'll count to three. One, two, three, and then I'll call on Alex.
No, I support. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Oh, great. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one note. I do support the proposal. A solution used in other parts of ICANN is to have a shadow Adobe Connect room so people can see what the visuals are. The downside of that is you cannot use it to confer. So just the thought, if that is a potential solution that ICANN was going to propose in this case, it does have the negative that you can't confer, and we should be able to weigh in on that if indeed that was the path people are going on. Thank you.
Right. What do you mean by confer, Alan?
You can't. They're in a different chat room, so they can't use in a different Adobe Connect, so they can't use the chat.
Right.
They see what's on the main chat on the main central screen, so they can follow visuals, but they can't use a common chat. So I'm just noting that is a solution used by MSSI, but it wouldn't address what was mentioned here, for instance. Thank you.
And Alan, why don't you think it would address that? Because I think I think the solution we would have we would still not. Alternates and observers would still not be able to contribute to the chat or speak in the meeting. So the idea is that they have full access to the material, which would be, you know, the deck or whatever documents up in front of you and the chat and the audio. So it would be full observing capability. So So I'm not quite understanding that. Go ahead.
If you're talking about allowing alternates into the same Adobe Connect room we're using today, but with restricted capabilities, then forget my comment. It doesn't apply.
Well, you'll come back later. Aiden, do you have anything contrary to say?
I do. Hi, everyone. This is Aiden Buffalim. I certainly appreciate that alternates wish to follow the core line. Very important. I get that. But the intent behind having alternates was to replace members who are unavailable. And we do want to maintain the balance that has been devised in how this EPDB has been constructed. So I would be very concerned if we were to have additional participants in the Adobe room, unless there is some technical way in which we can prevent alternates and others from being able to use the chat. If it is simply that they can see the slide deck and hear the audio, that would be fine, of course. But I can easily envision a situation in which we have additional participants commenting in the chat, perhaps in their, you know, prefacing their message by noting that they're an observer. And I'm not sure that would be helpful for anyone. But I do note, and as Alan noted, that for some other meetings, for instance, when the board has public meetings, there is the ability to have two Adobe rooms, one for the board members and one for public observers. So perhaps if there was a way that we could have that, a separate Adobe that others can access so that they can still see the visual material and they can still see and mirror the note tab in the agenda and they can hear the audio, I think that would be a good compromise. Thanks.
Okay, with that discussion, I see Marika's got her hand up, and like I said, we've been talking about this predating the comments, and ICANN staff has been working on certain things. So could you go ahead, Marika?
Thank you very much, Kurt. This is Marika. So as Kurt noted, we've been discussing this internally as well as considering what the options are to, on the one hand, satisfy the need of alternates to be able to follow where the group is on the slide, as well as seeing what's in the chat, while at the same time also respecting that the AC room is for members and alternates have a specific role as outlined in the charter. So what we're currently working on and actually testing, I think you may see an unknown name on the participants, is a way to live stream the Adobe Connect room in a separate Adobe Connect room, which we would then open up for alternates and observers so they can real-time see what the group is looking at as well as see the chat without actually being in the AC room, so we don't immediately have as well a long list of participants, and it may be difficult then to track who are members, who are alternates, who have the right to speak for the meeting and who doesn't. So we're testing that for this meeting, and we hope we'll be able to implement this already at the earliest on Thursday's meeting. So hopefully that will be a compromise between some of the views expressed on the call today and allow everyone to participate in a way that makes it real-time while still respecting the differences of time in the charter.
Thanks, Mark. Alan, is that a new hand? No, Lorraine?
Yes, and I appreciate that compromise, and I absolutely think that will move the ball forward. However, I'm a bit puzzled as to the obstacles that are outlined in the last statement. It's very clear who's an alternate, because right now I'm identified as GAC alternate, so I don't think there would be confusion about who is an alternate. And it also seems to be based on, to echo Thomas's comments, a suspicion that the alternates are incapable or unwilling to follow the rules of the road here, which I think is doesn't have any factual basis at this point in time. And again, since the charter explicitly asks for the alternates to be keeping up with things and to be able to confer with the rest of their colleagues in order to do the work of the group. I re-emphasize the need to collaborate via private chat in real time. If there came a time when this was being abused, I think it could be then reconsidered. But the basis of the concerns here really seem to stem from a distrust that the alternates are not going to follow the rules of the road, and I think that is a bit infantilizing view of the alternates. I think everyone could act as grown-ups, and actually the whole motivation here is just so we can do the work efficiently and effectively, and I would advocate that real-time access to the chat room with the ability for private but not public chats is a necessary component of that. That said, I appreciate the spirit of compromise, but I just wanted to point out the disadvantages to this proposed approach.
Okay, thanks, Lauren. And the two comments, the one comment I'll make is, you know, what this enables us to do is allow all the observers to attend using all of their senses, also the sights as well as sound. So it improves the what we're communicating in our transparency in the meeting in that way. And I guess I'll go ahead and make the second point that, you know, just pragmatically, every group on this call has their own private Skype or Slack or some other kind of chat going on that where they can have group chats where we can't have that in Adobe Connect. So we're going to take your comments on board. We're going to report them to the council where I am told the ultimate authority for this thing lies, not in my pay grade, and launch the facility that's been developed for the Thursday meeting unless there's some problem with it, and see how that goes. But all the comments have been memorialized, and they'll be duly reported as, you know, in some cases this solution is appreciated, in some cases it's deemed to fall a little short. So I have one more point in the updates from the EPDP chair, and that is the draft triage report. So I didn't finish that in time for this meeting, and I say the word I because the ICANN staff support did a lot of work on it, and I had some ideas about how to summarize the issues a little better than before. So I'll forward them today, and the plan is to have the draft triage report that Mark from the RYSG suggested we do today or tomorrow. So that's the update on that. So if there are no more questions at 6:24, we'll get into the substance. Is that okay with everyone? Any questions or comments? Great. So this is the thing that we're not going to call the scorecard, but rather it's a summary of the survey responses to the sections of the temporary specification that we're going to review today. You know, frankly, in some cases, I'm surprised by the red because in a lot of cases, these are just incorporations of appendices where we're not debating the substance of the appendices. We're just talking about whether the appendices should be incorporated into the main agreement or not. So I know there's some underlying reasoning here, but I think some of this we might be able to get through fairly quickly. So the first sections I want to discuss, or we want to discuss today, are in Section 5, which are requirements applicable to registry operators and registrars. And the first sections have to do with the publication of data that the registry operator and registrar must comply with the requirements in Appendix A, that certain SLAs be incorporated into this agreement by a certain date, that data escrow be accomplished in accordance with Appendix B, that data processing be required in Appendix C, that international data be accompanied by the right sort of agreements that makes that international data transfer GDPR compliant. I actually have some experience in that. That URS be maintained through certain machinations, and that ICANN contractual compliance receive some data. So with regard to these, you know, in 5.1 and 5.2, there were a lot of no's about, you know, paragraph 5.1, but they mostly pointed to the appendix and not this. So, and we're going to discuss that appendix in depth. So I don't know if we need to really register displeasure with this section based on that. In 5.2, you know, the rubs there were, one, there was a required date in there that this be closed out by the end of last month, and obviously it hasn't. So that hasn't been changed. And then in the next sections, you know, most groups support these clauses, but like I said, there's disagreement as to the content of the appendices, and especially the one with regard to international data. You know, there was a discussion about whether the wording adequately addresses all the possible combinations of countries involved in data transfer. And, you know, that makes me think that 5.5 should either be more detailed or a lot less detailed, and just say, you know, when doing international data transfers, you have to comply with GDPR. And in 5.7, which is the one about ICANN compliance, there were comments that ICANN really needs to define the purposes of each bit of data or each section of data it gets for compliance, so that, you know, the principles of minimization are met and that the purpose for the disclosure overcomes the right to privacy. So with those, let's take the discussion from those who object to these. So Christina and then Thomas.
Sure, this is Christina. My concern is really with the issue summary for 5.1. I think in the interest of avoiding any future uncertainty, I think the sentence that appears in the issue summary for 5.3, 5.4, and 5.5, namely there's disagreement regarding the content of the appendices, should also be included in the issue summary for 5.1. Because to have it in one place and not the other suggests that there's disagreement in content for one section and not the other, and that's not accurate, at least based on my review of the responses.
Well, there's a reason why Thomas is not speaking, is because I called him while I was on mute. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Kurt. Hi, everyone. It's Thomas speaking. My concern with 5.3 forward is that ICANN is not mentioned as a party here. And if this group chooses to discuss this elsewhere, this is fine. But that's the reason for the objection that I raised, because as far as my legal assessment, as well as that of many others, is concerned, for data escrow, ICANN is the controller, and the registrar operator and the registrars are processors on the ICANN. And I think we need to make that relationship legally safe as well, and that would include some requirements for ICANN to enter into data processing agreements with the escrow agents for registries and registrars.
Thanks, Thomas. I read that comment this morning when I was going through that, so thanks for bringing that up. Alan?
Thank you. The ALAC comment on, for instance, on 5.5 was not necessarily a comment, but was more of a question which might result in our objection. The wording in the section says that you should use processes that are deemed adequate, or if not, use the processes described in Chapter 5. And it wasn't clear, both from that description and my reading of the GDPR, whether in all cases there were adequate processes available. So the question is, if there are things that cannot, pairs of countries or organizations that cannot satisfy Chapter 5, it's not clear what the next fallback is. So I think it needs to be clear on that. Either someone to clarify that there are always processes that meet Chapter 5, or identify what happens if they can't. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I'm just taking a note. I shouldn't be doing that, huh? Any more comments on this section? I think those were well put, and I'll go on to the next. Okay, section 6 is requirements applicable to registrars only, registry operators only. Which have to do with providing bulk registration data access to ICANN, providing monthly reports, and a discussion on the RRA. Particularly, the registry constituency made a comment that 6.2, the registry monthly report, should be removed. And 6.3, there were comments about the RRA being between two other parties, so might not be the I'm trying to read the chat at the same time. I'm not good at this. So with the registry-registrar agreements, probably not suitable for this. So I'd like to hear the reason. I have an opinion on this, so I'd like to hear the reasoning on these. So Mark?
Hey, Kurt, this is Mark Anderson. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, great. Sorry, this isn't a comment specifically on Section 6 here. I just have sort of a general question here. I want to I'm not sure I understand exactly what we're accomplishing right now. You've posted a high-level summary of the comments received, and we're running through these high-level summaries. My sense is that we're not intending to get into a substantive debate on these topics right now, but rather this is sort of an overview of the summaries, maybe with an eye towards the eventual drafting of the triage document. But I guess I just want to clarify, what we're accomplishing right now, what our goals are for this section of the meeting. Thanks.
Thanks, Thomas. So for me, the original purpose of this exercise was to identify who agreed with, if there was consensus agreement around any sections of the temporary specification as written, and if so, post those out and report them to the GNSO. And also to identify where there was an agreement, what the issues were with those particular sections. So the idea of the comment summaries is really to put in succinct fashion a summary of the germane comments made about each section. And so I see the comment summaries as a tool for driving the discussion in the next phase, where we'll aim to hone or amend these sections of the temporary specification. So the issue summary would sort of go at the top of the page, and that doesn't mean we would ignore the individual comments that have already been made. That'll be part of that too. But what I plan to do is, with the help of the ICANN team, is again to take these issue summaries, go off, and when we have the next round of discussion, try to really narrow down the focus of each discussion. So we want to use that narrowing as a tool to go forward. I hope that was helpful. And I'll pause for a second to see if Thomas wants to come back, if Mark wants to come back.
Thanks, Chris. Mark, I guess that helps a little, but let me ask, you know, sort of with an example here. So back on section 5.5, you know, one of the comments the registries had submitted was that the language use isn't very precise, I guess, for lack of a better word here. And for example, in the wording of 5.5, you know, if you take a literal interpretation, it says, you know, the registrar, you know, must transfer personal data. You know, the way it's worded, it makes it sound like, you know, it could be interpreted to mean registrars or registry operators must use standard contractual clauses or successor clauses. But that's only one of the mechanisms, you know, the possible mechanisms permitted under GDPR. And I don't think that's the intent of the language. I think the intent of the language is that, you know, that's one of the mechanisms you can use, not that you must use that one. You know, so I guess, you know, with that as an example, is that the type of thing we should be raising here? Or is that the kind of, you know, or is that, you know, too much detail for this conversation here today?
Yes, I think that would be a good point to raise. I think that's the right level. And we'll not debate, then in this phase, we would not debate whether GDPR allows that, you know, alternate forms of ensuring international data transfers are done in compliance with the GDPR. We would just note that's the issue so that we can capture it for later. And, you know, anyway, I've said enough. Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. Caboose?
Just I want to draw your attention that although we tried our best to come up with a coordinated reply to each section or subsections, but our reply have been or continue to be accompanied by some comments seeking clarification or proposing revisiting the language. I hope that that will be taken into account. Otherwise, we would have certain difficulty in future to come up with a coordinated positive reply, because we discussed with our colleagues that, don't worry, if you have any comment or clarification or suggestion for improvement, please make it, but still keep in mind that it's better we have a more positive reply than any non-positive or no reply. Please kindly consider our comments. We have some comments on this part too. Thank you.
Thanks, Kibus. That's a good comment. I noted that in the GAC inputs to that, and identified opportunities where, you know, briefing from registrars or registries on mechanics might be helpful or others. And I see the comment in the chat about, I don't agree with narrowing down discussion. So, and I appreciate that comment. And when I say narrowing down discussions, what I mean is not eliminating topics or discussion topics or issues, but rather making the conversations with them as precise as possible, you know, identifying the issues as precisely as possible. So, you know, rather than plopping one big issue on the table, discussing a number of them. So it has to do more with precisions rather than not. I really want to hear from the registries why they want to eliminate Section 6.2 and the comment they made about 6.3. But go ahead, Milton.
Yes, thank you. Kurt, I am kind of picking up on the comments that Mark made in terms of what we're doing here, and I made a email to the list which called out some of the issues. So what you're doing here is you're being several sections of a very complicated document, a document that cross-references appendices and other parts of the RAA, all kinds of things going on. And then you're putting three or four of these into a single section, sometimes five, and then you're discovering that somebody objects to one part of that grouping, and so you say we don't have consensus. I'm wondering, in these online discussions, whether we can get more to the substantive issues and not just simply tally up yeses and nos and get a better sense. For example, as I pointed out in my email, you know, in terms of what data should be redacted, there really wasn't any disagreement. We had consensus on that, and that should go into the triage report. But because it was grouped with a bunch of other things that people were quibbling about, it looked like we don't have consensus on that point. So I'm concerned about I'm happy that we're discussing these section by section, and I think some of the substantive issues are coming out, but I'm a little bit concerned about the way the record of who supports what is being maintained because of the grouping. Do you understand my concern here?
Yes, and, you know, I've noted in the triage report I've written so far that, you know, we have these, you know, this sort of recording is more section by section, even though some of them are grouped. But I've noted that, you know, where there's yeses, the yeses are often accompanied by improvements or edits to the language. And the nos are sometimes in reference to a different section. So the color is not indicative of the sorry, I had a brain fade there. And then the second thing I wanted to say, well, I want to say three things. The second thing I want to say is I understand in this discussion that the grouping is somewhat awkward, but somewhat necessitated by trying to move through the issues. And so it's sort of a balancing, and there's quite a bit of effort going into trying to limit the grouping into like-minded items. And the third comment I want to make is that, you know, we have an obligation to do this triage report, and I, you know, we could skip this part, but I just didn't want to publish this triage report without pausing to get an understanding of the comments of where people were. And in fact, you know, with each meeting, we have improvements on this. So, you know, I don't disagree with any of your points, but
well, I'm just saying exactly what you are, that we have to discuss the substance of here, but we have to somehow sort out those things where there's actual agreement, particularly substantive things, and sift through these sort of quibbling things where people are proposing language changes, or maybe the registrars understand how this affects them contractually that we don't, so we might change our position based on the discussion. I think it's very important to keep track of this.
Right. And the comments are kept track of, and we've got to get so to me, we have to get through this section and memorialize the higher-level comments on the report so we can make this initial report to the GNSO. But I also think this is helpful for you know, so after these meetings, we take a step back, look at all the comments, and then do a better job of setting up this discussion for the more detailed talk you're speaking of later on. Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. And not to be a broken record, but I have pointed out that a full postmortem on the RDS would have been useful. We discovered through the RDS, as we were doing doodle polls, that admittedly were I think the construct of the doodle polls was worse in most cases than the construction of this particular exercise. But the same problems arise. Are reading too much into the responses when there are so many things bundled together. In many of these cases, the terms haven't been properly defined. That issue has been raised in the chat by the ALAC reps. You can't say yes or no until you know what a definition of a term is. So, quite frankly, I think what we're demonstrating here is that we're following the same path we did in the RDS, which didn't end well, and we're demonstrating, as we did in the first half hour of this exercise today, that there isn't a whole lot of trust here. So by the time we're through this, we will be wondering how fulsome our responses are going to have to be to cover all possible interpretations of what we're putting. And I don't think that's useful. I think we need to rather quickly get down to the nitty-gritty, define our terms, and start teasing these apart. I would also say one more thing, that we are starting with the temp spec, which is fine. It's a logical way to proceed. But we also need to get into just how good a job did the temp spec do of assessing the GDPR implications of all registration data policy at ICANN, because they're all so interlinked. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. And, you know, the idea of a postmortem on the other policy development is not a bad idea. And I've thought about, I haven't reached out to Chuck, and I should, but maybe for those who are interested, we could do that outside of this. Alan?
Thank you. I'll try to be quick. In retrospect, it's unfortunate that we didn't ask the question of, do you agree in principle with this section, and not merge yeses and nos with, but there's something that has to be changed to clarify it or because a date changed. Some people have said no because there were some wording changes. Other people you just said had said yes and then put comments in, even though that's not what the instructions said. So we're not going to do this over again at this point. So I think we need to get through this as quickly as possible and get to the substance, because I don't think we're going to end up with as much clarity as we could have, in another dimension if we had worded things a little bit differently. Thank you.
Okay, and I think, we have to, the substantive input is always more important than yes or no's in any event, and that's what we'll focus on. Caboose?
Yes, I understand that some people want that when we say yes, provide rationale for that. I don't think so. Our reply to yes is in two categories. Yes, without any need for any clarification or any suggestions for improvement or other wordings. The other yes is yes with some need for clarification or improvement. However, when we come to no, we need to describe the rationale for no. And in that case, people could discuss with a view to remove the doubt of the people that such no becomes yes, possibly. But I don't think that for yes we need a rationale. For yes is absolute yes, or yes with clarifications and suggestion for improvement or some change of the words. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. Benedict, how are you?
Hey, hi, Kat. Little bit of substantive input from me. I'm here representing SFAC, but also run a registrar, as some of you may know. Now, I run a registrar, but I don't actually operate my registrar. Like many people, I use a registrar operator backend in two cows. And it strikes me that it might be a good idea to have these registrar operators or registrar backends contributing to this discussion, because, frankly, they make policy. So two cows has imposed on me a GDPR, or rather, in my opinion, a sort of overcompliance of GDPR. And there, just to give an example, their implementation requires consent of the registrant for the data to be shared, their contact data to be shared with the registry, which seems to me quite an extreme implementation. And that consent is sought from my registrants without my consent, or without my sort of explicit consent, on a per TLD basis. So this is my operator reaching out to registrants and imposing their GDPR implementation on those people on a sort of blanket basis. So I think it might be an idea to, if we're going to talk about Section 6 and what's shared between registries and registrars, to at least invite or solicit some input from those organizations that are providing those.
Yeah, thanks very much, Benedict. Christina?
I can try and answer the questions you posed, unless there's somebody else who wants to speak on some of the other issues about the summaries generally.
No, go ahead, please.
Okay. All right. So for number 6.6, section 6.2, the issues that the registry had is that the date is obviously in the past, and I know that Mark is much more involved on the RDAP work with ICANN, so he can speak to more specifically where that work stands, but that basically the language that's in 6.2 is just not relevant. It's kind of been superseded by what's happened in practice. With regard to 6.3, this is where we start to get into the issue of kind of the picket fence and what is within and beyond the scope of consensus policy. And, you know, the registry stakeholder group view really is that this gets into an area that kind of goes beyond the picket fence. And for those of you who have not read it, I, rather than trying to read it all or get into a detailed explanation at this point, I think it would be really helpful if everyone would kind of take back for reading homework, at least from the registry side. I'm sure that Matt and Emily can speak on the registrar side. But read specification 1 to the standard registry agreement, the new GTLD registry agreement, and that kind of sets out the parameters of what consensus policy can cover, and it's our view that this goes beyond that. That's this very short explanation.
And to me, this is not a policy per se. This is a specification, and the ICANN board can pass emergency policies or temporary specifications, and the requirement for the registrar agreement, for example, is in the registry agreement. And so this amends that to say your registrar agreements have to be GDPR compliant, essentially. So I don't think this attempts to dictate certain terms in the registrar agreement. It just calls attention to the fact that you have already got this requirement for registrar agreement to be written under certain parameters in your agreement, and this adds the GDPR requirement. So that's where my confusion is. Doesn't this sort of have to be in a temporary specification? That's something that says, you know, the registrar agreements must also be compliant with GDPR.
Sorry, I was talking while still on mute. So here is kind of the issue, and this is where I think it gets really, really complicated, is that, you know, are you looking at the language of the temp spec because that's one issue. Or are we looking at this, doing this exercise for purposes of what we as a policy development process working group think should be consensus policy? And on the understanding that we are looking at this from that latter perspective, now we're focusing on the consensus policy, that's where the registries are drawing the line.
Okay. Benedict?
Old hands.
James?
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking, and this is going back a few moments previously and also responding to some of the exchanges in the chat. So I don't know how relevant this is to where we are currently, so I'll just point out that registrars were participating in the development of the temporary specification. They are essentially bound by it as if it were a consensus policy and therefore part of their enforceable contract. And it's up to the registrars to determine how they enforce these requirements and pass along those compliance obligations to their resellers and to their back-end customers and any other business partners that they have that are not accredited directly with ICANN and are not directly responsible for complying with the temporary spec. So I just want to point that out because I think that opening this up to, for lack of a better term, a lot of downstream parties that aren't directly involved in this contract, I think confuses things and takes us down a number of rabbit holes that we should probably avoid in the interest of completing our work in a timely fashion. So thanks.
Thank you, James. Margie?
Yes, this is Margie. Regarding the comment of the scope of the picket fence, I'm having a hard time following where some of this falls outside of the consensus policies. I'm very familiar with both contracts. And I think maybe the best way to approach it would be to be specific on what areas you think are outside the picket fence. And maybe we just by email, it's not something we need to do on this call. And then we can, share observations on why we think or don't think it's within the picket fence. But I think it's dangerous to assume things are outside of the picket fence unless we've done that analysis and have really, if there is a disagreement about how the contracts read, let's, ask ICANN staff about it. But let's not make assumptions until we've at least explored what is considered to be outside the picket fence and whether that is a position that ICANN staff supports.
Thanks, Margie. Thomas?
Thanks, Kurt. I'm not going to rehash what I've submitted in writing, but I guess one point is reappearing on the issue summary, and that is that the language of 6.3 explicitly refers to Article 28, which must be abided by. Yet, for processing registration data, ICANN, when registrars are likely joint controllers, and that would be governed by Article 26. So I think this group should discuss at some point whether the Article 26 rule should be taken, and therefore, we should probably highlight this as an overarching issue, because then a joint controller agreement would need to be entered into between ICANN and the contracted parties.
Thank you, Thomas. Christina, did you mention 6.2 and why that should be eliminated? Or can somebody speak to that? Did I dismiss it?
No, I did. It was kind of superseded by events. And I saw that Mark had his hand up, so I don't know if he – I know that he's been working very closely on the RDAP work, so I don't know if he wants to speak to that more directly.
Mark, do you have a comment on that before I – go ahead, Mark, and then Caboose, I'll catch up with you right away.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. This is Mark Anderson for the transcript. And, I think Christine put it just fine. It's sort of, overcome by events. If we're talking about, the purpose of this discussion, getting into, what will be our – our policy recommendations, you know, bear in mind, you know, the ultimate, you know, output of this group is to make new policy recommendations. This section 6.2 occurs, you know, in the past, and, you know, will essentially be overcome by events. And so,
I see. Okay.
The conversation is, you know, does this apply to consensus policy, you know, our discussions on what our consensus recommendations should be? No, it really doesn't. I think that's the point we're trying to make there.
Great. Thanks. Sorry. Caboose?
Yes, once again, we have some comment on this. The first comment is that what is additional reporting requirements? Reporting requirements is one thing, and additional reporting requirements is another thing, in addition to what? So this is, and please, once again, I don't want to take up your time, but please kindly read our clarifications and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. Christina, that's a good comment. That should be captured in the next round of issue summaries. All right, I'm going to leave this behind and go on to the registrar requirements. And we read through the section 7.1.1 through 7.1.15, and I sort of, you know, I'm sympathetic to the comments made that, you know, I would term them as being overly prescriptive. In other words, are we sure this covers the field? So if a registrar were to comply with these 15 things in notices to registrar name holders, would that completely cover the field and comply with GDPR? Do business models require some and obviate the need of others? Everybody that's registrars and registries and others have crafted their own notice to each registered name holder and each customer and each person to whom we take data. We've all crafted our privacy notices, and they're all somewhat different. It's the responsibility of each business owner to make sure they're compliant with GDPR. So I wonder if, I have sympathy for the idea that this does not, detailing it out this way is the terms may not be necessary or sufficient. So I have sympathy with that. Also with a comment about, I think it was probably Thomas's comment about not including ICANN's role, and highlighted the problem with this amount of detail is that by providing this much detail, it raises questions about the definition of certain terms. So, with that, I'll open this for comments. Ha, I said something right in the minds of some people. Are there any contrary views? Alex?
Hi, it's Alex. It's not a contrary view. I just wanted to kind of make the point we made in our comments, which is it's kind of up to us as a team to define what these specific purposes are and who the intended recipients should be. That's the detail that I think we need to agree to as a group. I think it would be unfortunate if it turned out that depending on the registrar, if the list of specific purposes and intended recipients were different. I think we need a single policy across all registries and registrars in this regard, and it's our job as a team to define what those are. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. All right, let's go on to, I'll pause for a second and then go on to sections 7.2 and 7.3. Where these things go on to the issue of consent and the opportunity to publish additional data, or where consent is sought by a registrar. So, and then 7.3 and 7.4, you know, this is one of those unfortunate groupings, but 7.3 and 7.4 really go to, we incorporate by reference appendices, where I think we're going to discuss that later. So I think for me anyhow, the issue of being able to accept consent to publication of data and how that's going to work, and the timing with which that's done, and how, you know, that might differ from business model to business model. You know, some business models may seek consent for specific purposes or specific markets, and some not. So, I don't. Well, I'll probably wind up reading it anyway. But, you know, some of the commenters talked about the difficulty of gaining consent, and the difficulty of multiple parties providing consent. So, if you have three different contacts, can one contact under GDPR provide the consent of others, even if they're in the same company, given what we've heard from the EDBPB? And the operational difficulties having to do with granting consent on a field-by-field basis. So, there were comments too about, you know, putting a timetable around consent. So, James?
Hi, Kurt. This is James. Can you hear me okay?
Sure, perfectly.
Oh, okay. Some folks were saying that my microphone was distorted last time. So, thanks, James speaking. And I think you summarized it correctly. I just want to point out that we have, sensation of the temporary specification, found some use cases where registrants have, you know, if you want to call it, opted into WHOIS or opted out of redaction or otherwise essentially given us consent and specifically requested to publish their data in an RDS system. I think some of the challenges, as you noted, is tracking that, sharing that consent with a registry, which we haven't really found a clean way to do, and then also, as you note, making the determination that that the registrant contact has obtained consent from any other contacts or information for other entities that might be listed in other contacts. And I think that's currently the subject of something that's working its way through the courts right now. So so I think you captured the summary correctly. Consent is very, very tricky. And I think we are finding that there is a very narrow use case for it. And I think the key here is to ensure that it's not overly applied to, you know, as a panacea for things that that we want to get ourselves out of. So thanks for your summary.
Yeah. Caboose?
Yes, now I have a comment on 7.2.1, and it is mentioned that the obligation of registrar to provide opportunity for the registered name holder to provide its consent is conditioned to commercially reasonable. Who decides that it is commercially reasonable? Registrar decides that? Or who else? Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose, and I won't presume to speak for contracted parties in that, and I have a thought on that, but if anybody wants to respond to Caboose, I think that'd be good. Emily?
Thanks, Kurt. I just wanted to add one more thing to
James's comments, which of course I support. It's the, you know, the generally the concept of consent in GDPR, as I know many on this call are, is that consent has to be as easily withdrawn as given. And so that sort of highlights some of the points that James was making of needing to track the status of that consent. And it's probably not as reliable or, you know, a sturdier basis for any actions relating to who is data collection, publication, and so on, as would be, for example, necessity or legitimate interest. So I just thought I would make that point. I think that many registrars will be implementing or have already implemented processes where registrants can positively opt in to have their data published should they wish to do so. And many corporations, of course, will have legal obligations to have their data in an accessible form, and they might choose to do that through WHOIS or perhaps as part of their website. So I hope that just provides an additional clarification on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. I think it's an additional complication. So I think to Kavusa's point, you know, it's for the contracted parties to determine what's commercially reasonable. But then part of that enters into the negotiations then that ICANN has with contracted parties on, you know, a variety of issues. So I think that's where it plays in. I noted sort of a point of order, but Stephanie's comment about, do we have a summary of all of ICANN's communications with the EDPB and probably other entities. So we should capture that and take an action to try to make a library of that if it doesn't exist, and easy to access and consult library if that doesn't exist. So I think, this topic of consent is a complex issue. And despite my earlier speech about keeping the issues narrow and simple, I think, you know, consent sort of plays together with, how data is accessed and under what circumstances it's disclosed, and therefore the uses of disclosed data and, you know, the role that that consent would play in helping or hindering that. So as we figure out how to have that this discussion about consent, we might have to consider other issues. Caboose, is that an old hand?
Yes, it's a new hand. I am just asking with respect to what is being discussed, the consent of the registered name holder. If this consent is withdrawn, what would happen to the information already provided? On one hand, we say the information will be kept for 2 years. On the other hand, if the consent is withdrawn, does it mean that all information also will be withdrawn immediately? Thank you.
Yeah, so that's it. So I think you can save a couple issues, but once data is disclosed, it's hard to undisclose it, right? So that's when contracted parties create consent, they'll necessarily have to be careful about how it's implemented that way, I think. Another great complexification. All right. So let's move on. I don't know if I didn't know if we'd get this far, so I don't know if I prepared this subject as well as I should have, but let's go on to Appendix B, which you can hear the rustling of pages in the background. Talks about data escrow requirements. And so in the first paragraph about data escrow requirements, there's a thought that this should be, there's an opinion that this should be struck because data escrow under the registrar accreditation agreement is different from who is data. So this is sort of the same discussion we had about one of the uses of data, or one of the reasons for data processing was to provide certain registrant protections, and it turns out that might not be germane. So this is the same sort of issue. And then, you know, as far as international transfers, you know, parallels can be drawn between this and the other topics and Chapter 5. And also that so again, these data processing requirements might be left better for the contracting parties to negotiate. So, you know, whereas I gave a good summary of the topic before, I gave a pretty bad summary of the topic on this one. But if we could hear from the parties that made these comments and to put a point on them, that would be terrific. And if somebody can watch the chat room so I can look at my hear from the registrars perhaps, and maybe Thomas on this. And finally, the ROISG pointed out that this conflicts with other requirements. Emily, thanks.
Thanks, Kurt. Yeah, I think that you summarized the point of view that we tried to put across accurately. It's really just questioning what detail provisions relating to data escrow are doing in a temporary specificating to who is. There are contractual obligations relating to data escrow. You know, so it's really just that simple point which you reflected in your remarks. Thanks.
Is there a contrary point of view here about, you know, that or a question about the intersection between data that's escrowed with that escrow provider and who is information? Anybody that was for these topics, do they understand the comments made against them? Okay, so sections in the appendix 3 and 4 with regard to data escrow has to do with ICANN approval of data escrow arrangements or data ICANN approval of amendment of data escrow arrangements. And than any additional requirements. And, you know, with regard to the ICANN approval, there's not much disagreement against that, but, you know, there's a need to clarify ICANN's approach, and I don't know whether we do that or whether that's done in a negotiation among the contracted parties or not. And then finally, the Appendix B, Section 4 was supported, but again calls out ICANN as the data controller. So, Thomas?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether we actually need to hear ICANN's position on this. I guess ICANN has made its position clear in this table that was in contemporary specification. So I think we should rather establish it as a fact that ICANN is the data controller for this processing activity, and the registries and the agents are the processor on their behalf. And then here ICANN's view on that.
Okay. Thanks, Thomas. That's a good clarification. So these are either not controversial, or we can pretty much set our watch on when people run out of gas. And as you can tell by my voice, that's happened here. So let's just talk lastly about Appendix F, which has got to be somewhere in the stack of papers I have in front of me. So it has to do with bulk registration data access to ICANN. And it's a very brief comment, but it was pointed out that domain names themselves might also be personal information. So we have to make a determination about whether or not this is this is properly written or needs to be analyzed. So, Benedict, you can talk about this topic or anything you'd like.
Hey, two points. One thing, have we got an indication from ICANN or bits of ICANN, for example, compliance or the security folks, if they've got a retention plan in place for that data, for data that's disclosed to them? Because I know that different parts of ICANN need onto data for different lengths, and obviously that processing is an important part of this decision, but probably not part of this PDP, worth capturing at some point because it might help inform our discussions. Second part is I think from the SAC perspective, we find it very hard on a technical basis to understand how a domain name could be construed as personal information. A domain name is almost, I think, implicitly an act of publishing to purchase a domain name. And unless I register the domain name, you know, Kurt Pritz lives at, so-and-so California, as a sort of way of disclosing your personal information without consent, about the most contrived example I can come up with. I cannot see how this could be construed as personal information, but I'd love to hear examples. Thank you.
Thanks. To your first point, Benedict, you asked about how ICANN is going to store this information or for how long, but isn't the intent of this Appendix F to strip out all the personal data out of that bulk registration data so that it would no longer fall under GDPR?
I hope that's the case, and my understanding is that some contact data is shared with ICANN at the moment. I haven't had a clarification on what process that uses and whether it's via escrow or directly. But I don't know if that's entirely true, but it'd be nice to have a view on that.
Okay, Thomas, do you want to respond to the question about a domain name could be personal information?
Yeah, I should clarify, I did not dispute the fact that this reporting is done, but whenever there's processing activity involving personally identifiable data, which a domain name can be, then you need to write in your record of processing activity, and you need to state on what legal basis you process it, how long you retain it, that's related to the point made earlier by Benedict. And I think maybe on that we should actually ask ICANN to share with us their processing activities with relating to reported data. And then we can make an assessment of whether we think that this is a good explanation or if some more thinking needs to be done. So again, as I mentioned in our response, this is not to dispute or object to the reporting as such, but we need to make sure that the way the reporting is conducted is legally compliant.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas. Marzi?
Thank you, Kurt. So my points were kind of raised already, but I just think that even regardless of personal data or not, having ICAM bulk access to data for the contractual compliance without mentioning how this can be processed and what it entails, I don't think that's the way to go, and it creates a contractual ambiguity. So that's the concern I have with the whole ICANN access to bulk registration data. And can we go to the previous slide? I just have a comment. I don't want to change the subject, so if you want, I can go. Okay. So basically, for the data scroll requirements, and I have seen this on a couple of other issues, that we are leaving this to the contracted party to negotiate with ICANN. And so I saw that someone explained that this is only until when ICANN actually distinguishes its role in this. But then there are many, many questions about the data processing, about the structured data sharing agreement that I think that I don't think it should solely be negotiated between ICANN and CPH. So I just wanted to put that out. I'm not very sure about the negotiating process, but I think if you're like putting everything in like negotiate with ICANN and the registrars and registries, you are kind of like limiting ourselves here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark?
Thanks. Thanks, Kurt. This is Mark Anderson. I want to comment on Appendix F for a second. There are a couple of things in there that are interesting. You know, first, I think, you know, Benedict raised some interesting questions about, you know, what is ICANN's retention policy on this data once they receive it? You know, are they processing it in a way that's compliant with GDPR and other applicable laws? And I think those are interesting questions, perhaps very valid, but are those questions that we need to address as part of our group or as part of our policy recommendations, or are those ICANN itself as the processor here needs to do to determine that they're processing this data in a way that complies with GDPR? I pose that sort of an open question, because I think that's an important one to consider. At some point it's been identified that there's a need for ICANN access to bulk registration data. We can say that, that need doesn't exist or it does exist, but then I think it's up to ICANN to make sure that they're doing that processing in accordance with GDPR.
Thanks, Mark. So I have two comments about that. One is, and I said this a minute ago, so maybe I didn't say it clearly, or maybe some of these issues just go by me, but to me, the way Appendix F is written is that ICANN is asking for just what's left, the non-personal data that, the registry operator must only provide the following data, which to me is a list, notwithstanding Thomas's argument that the domain name might be personal information. This would be all be non-personal information, and therefore, in the case of Appendix F, you know, maybe we don't care because I can't deal with this by saying when you share this bulk registration data, you're no longer going to be sharing personal data. So that's my one comment. And then my second comment that I'd almost love to make is, you know, I think this is a question for registries, registrars, and to a certain extent others in this room where, you know, you're touching the data and I can't touch the data. So to a certain extent, you're wrapped up in this or together or not. So you might, if you're disclosing data to ICANN, then you might care or not how ICANN deals with it. So you might care that this is part of the temporary specification, how ICANN handles data. So I don't know.
So, Kurt, this is Mark again. Can I keep going?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I should have started with this point is, you know, I guess maybe just some background. Looking at the section in Appendix F versus what's in the base registry agreement, you know, what this essentially changes. Is the original language so something to the tune of, you know, registry operator must provide at a minimum this data, and it lists sort of the fields that you have here. But the base registry agreement language lists the minimum data that must be provided. And so I think the change that ICANN made here is to be more explicit and say you must only provide. You know, I think what ICANN was attempting to do was make sure they're only getting the data necessary for this purpose, this bulk registration data access purpose. And so that was what was reflected in the registry comments is, you know, understanding that the clarification from ICANN was just for that purpose to change a at minimum to a must only, then that's fine. But then to the extent you brought up, there's maybe sort of a broader context around, you know, the processing activity that occurs. Is this legitimate? And is that even, you know, is that even a problem for us to solve, or is that up to ICANN to solve here? You know, and you said, you know, if this, you know, you understand that this contains only non-personally identifiable information, then it's no problem. It doesn't apply. You know, and I would respond that that's not really that's not our decision to make. You know, ICANN in determining if they're performing this activity in compliance with GDPR would make that determination on their own. You know, if they determine, hey, this contains no PAI or isn't subject to GDPR, then we're fine. You know, I think that's their determination to make, and that we wouldn't have to weigh in, you know, sort of delve into that. So, hope that helps.
Yes, thanks for that discussion and indulging me. Are there any other comments on the substance of what we talked about? I've certainly taken on board a lot of the comments in the beginning about the purpose of these discussions, and I've thought a lot about how to, there's quite a bit of homework involved in taking advantage of the statements that have been made here, everything in the chat, and the effort that's gone into the comments to make sure that we utilize the effort everybody's gone through here. So, and I have some ideas about how to get that homework done. He pauses for a second, and then I want to. So, Marika, did you want to speak?
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. I can cover the next item, review the action items and the questions for ICANN org, if any identified in this meeting, if that's helpful.
That would be helpful.
Okay, so the action items and you know, we'll, of course, circulate the detailed notes as well as the action items shortly following this meeting. So the action items that staff has captured is that staff is to circulate the proposed communication plan with the EPDP team for your input and review. Of course, a related action item is for you all to review this communications plan and provide your feedback. Staff is also to share instructions for use of the alternative Adobe Connect room with AC streaming at Thursday's meeting. An action item for the council liaison, Rafiq, is to provide an update on participation of alternates to the GNSO council and determine whether there are any concerns about the proposed approach for live streaming at the AC room to facilitate read-only access to the AC for alternates. And staff has committed to share a presentation that Becky Burr provided to the GNSO council in relation to the picket fence. And then EPDP members are to complete the survey at part three by Wednesday, the 15th of August at 1900 UTC. And one question that we've captured for ICANN.org is there a list and summary of ICANN contacts and engagement with the EDPB and or other DPAs in relation to the temporary specification for GTLD registration data?
Thanks for that. I think going forward, maybe we can like sort of type those up as we go in some rough fashion and just splash them up there. But we will take those action items and others we recover after we review the chat and the comments that you made and augment them if necessary. Ashley?
Thanks. So something was just triggered in terms of a question. For the LA meeting in September, is there a prohibition on alternates attending as, you know, just being in the room and, you know, still adhering to the rules? Because a three-day period, at least for the GAC in particular, who has only three representatives, it could cover a lot of territory that perhaps the primaries don't have all of the expertise. So it would be helpful if our alternates are able to come to the meeting that they'd be able to do so. Is that something that's feasible?
I think it is, but we're working through it. So there's some space constraints for one. So we'd want to assess demand for that sort of space because it might require us leaving the ICANN offices and finding a place in a hotel. But we're certainly working on ways to accommodate that. And I've read, the emails from several of you about this.
Thank you, Kurt. Farzana Baiji speaking. I totally disagree with alternates being able to attend the EPDP meeting while their members are present. Alternate, in my dictionary, means someone who laces someone else in their absence. And this will allow, and we are having this discussion about them being following real time, and now they're going to come to the meeting. And so, well, we had this group closed and kind of like members appointed not to have like a bigger group, and then now we are going that way. I totally disagree. We should not have give alternates other roles. Their role is to replace their member in their absence. That's one thing. The other thing was that, well, I wanted to talk about Appendix F, but I can just talk about it later because I'm on the mailing list. Thank you.
Thank you. Kavus?
Yes, Kurt. I would like to draw the attention of Marika that the point that I raised at the beginning of the meeting is an action item to be brought to the attention of the President and CEO of ICANN. This is very important, and I'm not going to continue to be suffered in future. That is an important issue, and it is formally to be brought to his attention. Thank you.
Yeah. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to note, the reason why we didn't capture that is that because an action item has already been completed, the letter that you sent to her has already been shared with Joran as well as Shireen. So to add it as a completed action item, but I just want you to know that that is an action that we have already completed.
Okay, great. And we want to capture also Kavu's comment at the start of the show here and make sure that's memorialized and forwarded. Kavu's, did you have one more thing? Or is that an old hand? Okay, great. So the next part three of the temp spec survey submissions is due Wednesday, August 15th at 1900 UTC, and because we'll be ready to talk about them on Thursday, that means a big late-night homework assignment for us. So if you could hit the 1900 UTC mark, that would be greatly appreciated. And I appreciate the continued energy that everybody's putting into those comments. I know it's a bit of a slog, but it's really important that the comments are written in a way that are clear and understandable, because they're very important to informing the future conversation. So I'll pause for a second to see if anybody has anything else to say. And then Benedict is typing in the best comment in the chat. He stopped typing.
I've stopped, Kat. I just wanted to ask if Aidan had any further reasoning behind his refusal to count as alternates, and just to give him a chance to speak before we come.
Okay.
So this is Aidan. Only commenting because I was called upon. And I wanted to simply plus one the comments that Farzaneh raised a few moments ago, in which we also spent discussing in the first half hour of this call. I have nothing else to add. We have a carefully constructed balance for this EPDP, and I think that the membership composition that was agreed by the Genozo Council should be respected. To allow alternates to also be, initially we were talking about just in the Adobe Connect room, and now to be participating in face-to-face meetings. No, I do not support that at all.
Okay, thanks, Aidan. And so let's we're conferring actually with the GNSO Council leadership on this to get their input, the ones who carefully constructed this balance. So with that, I'm going to let everybody go for the rest of the day. Thank you again so much for starting on time and your participation in constructive comments during the meeting. So thanks a lot, everybody, and I'll talk to you in a couple days. So long.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.